A U.S. district judge last week sentenced former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin to serve 21 years in federal prison for violating George Floyd's civil rights. He's already been serving time after being found guilty of murdering Floyd by kneeling on his neck for 9.5 minutes. But there's a lot more to George Floyd's story. Two reporters from the Washington Post spent more than a year trying to reconstruct his life for a new book. They interviewed friends, family, people who knew him and loved him. They walked his streets, went where he went, to be able to tell the full story of the man whose killing on May 25th, 2020, inspired a summer of racial justice protests. They also wanted to better understand the policies affecting African Americans that can be linked to Floyd winding up in Minneapolis, unemployed and battling addiction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you been reflecting on the 2 years since the killing of George Floyd? Where do you see the racial justice movement it inspired making progress? What more do you think needs to be done to make a real difference at the local, state, or federal level? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tolu Olorunipa is a national reporter for The Washington Post. He's co-author of the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Tolu, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you, Dean.
And Robert Samuels is a national reporter for The Post. He's the other co-author of His Name is George Floyd. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Dean.
This book was a real journey for both of you. You covered hundreds of miles, did hundreds of interviews. Tolu, I want to start with you. What motivated you to take this approach, to put in the work, and create a really intimate portrait of George Floyd?
Well, this all started with a series that we did in the Washington Post back in 2020, where we wanted to find out more about George Floyd's life, not just the video that everyone saw of him dying, but we wanted to find out what it was like for him to live in America as a Black man, as someone who grew up poor, and as someone who faced systemic racism and the suffocating pressure of institutional injustice from the time he was born, even decades and centuries before he was born, when we talk about his family. And we did that series and saw that there was so much more to his story. And we decided to spend a little bit more time digging more deeply into his background and into the events that happened after his death in 2021. And we were able to formulate that into a book in which we were able to tell not only the story of one man's life, but also the story of America, the story of the Black American experience, and show how the injustices that George Floyd faced in his death and during his life reflect what so many other people face. And it showed how, you know, his striving and his efforts to try to live a better life and stumbling and struggling and having issues of his own and trying to overcome his past as part of the American experience, as part of the American story. And we wanted to show how his experience differed from the experience of other people who may have gotten a little bit more grace in their lives than he did. And we thought that might be able to reflect a little bit about how institutional racism works in the 21st century.
And in order to tell the story in that way, you had to really be on the ground with his family, with his friends, building trust and relationships. Robert, I know one person you spent a lot of time with was Maurice Hall, someone he was with on the day he was killed, and a lot of other friends and contacts of George Floyd. How did you go about establishing contact and building that trust?
We worked really hard for it because we knew this was a world that could be pretty unforgiving for people to tell the truth and to tell their full story. And we also knew there was a lot of skepticism. What we told people when we started thinking about this project was that we were not so interested in how George Floyd died. We wanted to tell the story of how he lived, but even more so, we wanted to let the world know and understand how systemic racism works in America. Maurice Hall, who was with George Floyd on the day he died, he drove with him to Cup Foods. He did not speak on the stand, but he talked to us because he believed in the mission. And so when we began this conversation, it really was bedrocked with this simple idea. One, do you believe systemic racism exists? Two, do you want to do your part to help eradicate it? Because as a journalist, I think it's anti-democratic and I want to do my part. And so we asked them to join with us in this process through not just telling his story, but to make sure that at every turn we looked at George Floyd's life with the right nuance and context, but we also told the story of the country in hopes that there might not be another George Floyd.
And I want to take a brief stop before we talk about George Floyd's life to talk about that of his great-great-grandfather, because you include a chapter in the book about Hillary Thomas Stewart, who at one point, after being born enslaved, grew to own over 500 acres of land in North Carolina. That's an inheritance that, hypothetically, George Floyd would have been born into. That wasn't the case, though. Talu, can you talk about what happened in the 1800s?
Yeah, I'm so glad you put it that way, because Hillary Thomas Stewart wanted to pass down his land to his descendants. He had been born enslaved, and he knew that coming into the world with nothing, and as many of his own ancestors did, leaving with nothing was not the way to do it. So as soon as he got his freedom, he saw that there was value in being able to work the land. He worked very hard with his large family and was able to amass through hard work 500 acres of land in North Carolina, making him one of the wealthiest Black men in his community at the time in the late 1800s. But at that time, it was a time of racial terror, and people did not like the fact that a Black man was wealthy in his community at that time, wealthier than many white people in his community. And they essentially had him dealt with. They used unscrupulous business deals and, you know, fake and fraudulent tax authorities decided to strip him of all of his land before he could make any transfers to his descendants. And as a result, all of his future generations ended up poor, and they worked hard and they worked as sharecroppers because they didn't have anything that they owned on their own. And even George Floyd's mother came into the world and she worked as a sharecropper in North Carolina. And that's part of the reason George Floyd came into the world poor, not just poor, but in deep poverty, living in a house without electricity and without houses. And the deep poverty of the American South is how he entered into the world. And his mother decided she wanted to leave North Carolina to relocate to Texas to try to get a better stance on life. But essentially, his family worked in North Carolina for more than two centuries, worked very hard. And despite all that hard work, he wasn't able to inherit any of that. And he came into the world essentially with an understanding that everything that you work for can be stripped away from you, like it was stripped away from his ancestors. And that's a very difficult way to experience the American dream and to experience all of the promise of the land of opportunity. And we saw the reverberations of that as George Floyd came into the world and tried to make a way for himself, growing up as a poor Black boy in the 1970s and the 1980s.
We're talking with Talu Olorunipa and Robert Samuels right now, co-authors of the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Talu, you spent a lot of time in Houston talking with Floyd's family, visiting his schools. What kind of portrait emerged to you of George Floyd growing up in Houston?
Yeah, he was a resident of Houston's Third Ward. He was well known in his community. This is a historically African-American community. It was designed to be segregated, but it's also a proud community, a very close-knit community. And George Floyd was someone who had stature because he came up in part because of his size and because of his diligence in pursuing athletics. He was well known in his community. He started off in third grade, and we talked to his teacher. He wanted to be a Supreme Court justice, and he was doing well in school early on. But as he got older and as he got taller, people realized that if he was going to try to make it out, they told him essentially that he should try sports. He should try to focus on athletics because he had this big athletic body and build. And he was doing pretty well in sports, but his academics fell behind as he attended a number of underfunded schools, and that made it hard for him to have a solid foundation to try to get to college. He did eventually go to college, but he had to drop out because his educational foundation was not strong enough. And as a result, his athletic dreams fell apart as well. And then that left him coming back to Houston as someone who didn't have a college degree, didn't have a sports contract, and had a number of issues in trying to prepare and protect his family and provide for them. And that led him down some dark choices, and the dark path of criminality and the criminal justice system was waiting for him. But one of the things we found out about George Floyd was, despite the fact that he made mistakes and despite the fact that the system was very unforgiving towards him, he was always willing to pick himself up, strive for a better life. It's part of the reason he left Houston late in life to move to Minneapolis, to go to rehab, to try to get clean, to try to get a job and provide for his family. So he was always someone who was like that. He was always trying to put the past behind him and reach for a better future. And he always had that optimism. He was someone that went around saying, "I love you," to everyone, because he wanted to spread that level of optimism around him, even when he was in a dark place, even when he made the mistakes that he later regretted, he always had that optimistic spirit that things would get better in the future.
And Robert, how does that compare or contrast with the Floyd that you learned about in Minneapolis, who arrived trying to reset his life a few years before his death? What did you learn about him there?
Well, George Floyd followed the path of his mother, right? Who we talked about leaving a system that was not built for her to succeed. And he found the same thing in Texas, where after he comes out of prison with the badge of a former felon, ex-felon, he can't get a job. He can't get a professional license, which is needed for 1 in 3 jobs in Texas. He couldn't become even a barber if he wanted to. So he boards a bus and he heads to Minneapolis because he hears the stories from his friends. We talk more about it in the book, about how people in Minneapolis, it's a more progressive city, they have a heart for people like him. He goes through a rehab program focused specifically on trying to heal Black men. And at first, he's doing pretty well. He gets a job, he gets a second job, he gets a girlfriend, he gets a nice townhome to rent with one of his friends from rehab. But the sad part about this, Dean, is that despite all those steps, the institutions that have the residue of racism still stuck in them continue to almost conspire against George Floyd. When he one day walks in and finds his roommate overdosed, he's then sent back into a world of depression and drug dependency without many systems that understood where he was coming from. And from then, he continually tried to build his life all the way up to May 2020, when he lost his job as a security guard because the coronavirus had struck. 1 in 2 African-Americans in Minnesota were unemployed. He was unemployed because the place where he worked was closed down. And he gets the virus himself. And so he's there trying to figure out a way to make sense of the world and continue that optimism that Tolu had alluded to on May 25th, 2020, which is the day the world learned the name George Floyd because he had encountered Derek Chauvin.
We're talking with Robert Samuels and Tolu Olorunipa right now, national reporters for The Washington Post and co-authors of the book His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the summer of 2020 and the aftermath of George Floyd's killing? How are you reflecting on that period and where the country is now? Do you think progress has been made and what work still needs to be done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Robert Samuels and Tolu Olorunipa, co-authors of the book His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Tolu, last week, we got the news that former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was sentenced to 21 years in prison for violating George Floyd's rights. I want to get your thoughts on Derek Chauvin and how that sentencing kind of has you thinking about the story that you're telling in the book. I know you have an entire chapter on Derek Chauvin in the book.
Yes, we did spend a lot of time delving into Derek Chauvin's past, his own personal history, his professional history as a police officer, because we wanted to find out more about why he did what he did. Everyone saw the video. They saw the callous nature and callous disregard for George Floyd's humanity. And we wanted to find out why he did that, how his training led him to that level of force to be used. And we found out that he used that kind of force regularly on a regular basis. And now that we've seen this most recent guilty plea in which he pled guilty to not only violating George Floyd's civil rights, but the civil rights of a 14-year-old boy who he hit with a flashlight and also used the neck restraint against. We document that case in the book. We also document several other cases of Derek Chauvin using the neck restraint against people who fit a number of different categories. Some of them were young children. Some of them were older. In almost every case, he used the excuse that they were bigger than he was, and he wanted to subdue them because of their size. And many times that involved him using a level of force that was more than what his colleagues on the force were using. He was known, and his precinct was known as being thumpers, in the words of people in the community who said that they would go and use force and then ask questions later. And we found that Derek Chauvin seemed to be of that mold and built in that mold. And that was sort of how he came up in the police force. And he was in that very same mold when he met George Floyd on May 25th, 2020. And rather than, using a little bit of grace and allowing George Floyd to breathe, he decided to essentially say that what he was doing was protocol, that he had called an ambulance and that everything would be okay as long as he just continued to keep his knee on George Floyd's neck. We wanted to be able to show that this was not an anomaly. This was not just a bad day. This was a culture of policing that had been built up in the Minneapolis Police Department, specifically in the 3rd Precinct and within Derek Chauvin, who had been on the force for 19 years. And he had spent a lot of time using these similar tactics and the similar level of force without being reprimanded, without being held accountable. We wanted to show that this is a systemic issue, not just one bad apple in a police department. And there are police departments all across the country that have these issues, and there's a push to try to reform some of that. But it's very deeply entrenched, and it was important for us to show that Derek Chauvin represents something larger than just one individual cop on one bad day.
And after George Floyd's killing, his family, especially his brother Philonis, became part of the racial justice movement that sprung up afterward. Robert, what did you hear from his family, his relatives and loved ones about the person they knew being an icon of racial justice?
It's a very strange path for them to see their brother and their nephew or their uncle. Most of his family called him Perry. Almost reduced to murals and hashtags because he was so much more than that. They knew him as a full person. In the book, we recount a story with Philonis and Joe Biden, and Philonis tells President Biden, "What we have to do is remember that my brother was more than a video." Now, I think it's also important to remember, Dean, that this family, because of their history, had always believed that the way to make it in America was to keep your head down, provide for your family, get a good job, not cause too much trouble. But when they saw the pernicious force of racism strike against their brother in his murder, they realized that that could not be the solution for their family. And so many of them stepped out, joined the call for racial justice, even though it was uncomfortable for them. We recount a scene in the book a little bit after Jacob Blake's death, where Philonis is trying to speak to a crowd and completely breaks down. But I think what we'd want viewers, and we hope readers, would take away from this book is that the Floyd's experience tells us something about how racism operates in the United States, right? That keeping one's head down, trying to ignore it, just trying to provide for your own would not be enough to prevent terrible things from happening. And it could happen to you, whether you're Black or white. Derek Chauvin was also molded by these same systems. And so the realization that the Floyd family is documented going through in the course of the pages of the book is a type of realization that we hope would echo in the hearts of readers.
And Talu, whether it's civil rights activists or Floyd's own family that took part in the movement, what points of action are you seeing, progress or inaction, in the 2 years since his death?
Well, there definitely has been some progress and change as a result of George Floyd's death and the uprising that took place of people taking to the streets to protest what they saw as a grave injustice. So we have seen a number of different states pass bans on chokeholds by police, bans on no-knock warrants, bans on a number of aggressive policing tactics. There was a push to try to get that same level of action at the federal level so that nationwide there will be certain standards. Unfortunately, for the activists who wanted those laws to be passed and for members of George Floyd's family, who pushed very strongly for that George Floyd Justice and Policing Act to be passed by Congress and signed by President Biden. The talks around that bill essentially ended in a stalemate, and there was no federal bill to be passed. Now, Joe Biden, the president, did sign an executive order a couple of months ago in which he tried to implement some of these policies through his own executive power. But, you know, there is a feeling among the activists that rather than, you know, this great social justice movement leading to major civil rights legislation, instead we have seen a backlash. We've seen, you know, a shortcoming in terms of the kinds of major changes that were expected. And there is a push to try to get more done, even in the face of this backlash, which comes in the form of people talking about critical race theory and saying that we shouldn't be talking about race as much as we should. And so there's this feeling that the struggle continues. And even as some of the momentum that was around George Floyd's death has faded, there's still a push to try to get something done and to try to continue the struggle for racial justice for the future.
We'll leave it there. Tolu, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Robert Samuels is a national enterprise reporter for The Post, one of the co-authors of the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. We were also joined by co-author Tolu Olorunipa.